Hello, and welcome to the Big Leads Press Pass Podcast. Today, I have with me a very special guest, a big fan of slow news. I have Kevin Clark of The Ringer fame. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm so glad to be here, Liam.
Oh, I'm very glad to hear it. And as always, Kevin, we're just going to launch right into it. And we're going to get to talk about your career, your experiences, and you know, the interesting path that you took. But it, as always, it just starts with a very simple question. When did you realize that sports journalism was a thing that you wanted to do?
I still haven't realized it. Wait, I'm in sports journalism? Oh, no. It was very gradual. Both my parents were journalists. My grandfather was a journalist starting in like the 1930s. I had an uncle who was a journalist. And so journalism was always around me. Mm-hmm. There were a handful of years I didn't want to be a writer. At one point I wanted to be in a punk rock band. At one point I wanted, like when I was like 15, I read Moneyball and wanted to be a baseball GM for a summer and then realized I didn't want to be a baseball GM pretty quickly. But other than that, like writing was always around me. And, you know, I would read these books when I was younger and I was like, oh, wow, I really want to do this. You know, like you'd read David Halberstam. I remember getting a David Halberstam book one time and just reading it like in one sitting on a weekend day or whatever. So I just realized very quickly that sports journalism is just really fun. And, you know, when you're a journalist, you realize like, oh, wow, you get paid to go to the Olympics. Oh, wow, you get paid to go to the Super Bowl. Like, that's pretty fun. And I was always just influenced by not only the great work that it was around, but also just like the fun opportunities that were your fingertips. And obviously, listen, that was a different era. Like when I was coming up, you know, early 2000s, mid 2000s, or whatever it was, newspapers still had a big budget. There were a bunch of magazines that would compete with each other that still had a big budget and they would send people to the Olympics. Like, I don't think that there's a ton of newspapers traveling to the Olympics right now. I don't think there's a ton of newspapers that put people on the road for training camps, stuff like that. It was a different era. The internet wasn't really a dominant force like that, but it still had a huge impact on me.
Oh, for sure. Was there any, I mean, given the fact that you talked somewhat fondly about your early childhood, I can't imagine there was, but was there any like familial pressure about kind of going into the family business?
No.
Big nature.
None. Yeah. None. But what I would say, so the Orlando Sentinel in, I don't know, let's say 2003. So let's look at their staff over the course of a couple of years. They had Jeff Darlington covering the Gators. They had Jamel Hill as a columnist. They had Charles Robinson on staff. They had Rick Mace, who's now at the Washington Post. And I remember just like reading, like Rick Mace like got an interview with O.J. Simpson and like to do, like he just doorstepped him at a autograph signing and like got him for an hour. And you're reading this and you're like 15 years old and you're like, Jesus, this is good. And I just, Joe Shad was on staff, like all of those guys. And you're reading the sports section, and I'm not going to make any comparisons to some of the best sports sections of all time or anything, but I just remember reading this and just being like, this is something that I'd like to aspire to. And those guys are, and you know, those, I'm going to start again, sorry, 320. And those people who are on that staff are, you know, they're still stars all over the place in the sports media industry. And so there wasn't any pressure, but it was more just like when you were growing up in that market, you just got to read really good stuff all the time. It's like, wow, I want to do this.
Yeah, I think in talking to other reporters for this podcast, that's definitely a huge part of it, is that if you don't, you know, wake up one day when you're 15 or whatever, and you're like, I want to be a sports journalist, a lot of it is about kind of where you grew up and the work that other reporters do that you just naturally are surrounded by just by virtue of where you are.
Yes.
And your interests.
Yeah, 100%. And like in the opportunities, and, you know, I probably lucked out in the sense that Florida has a ton of pro sports teams, college teams. There were opportunities there. I was covering teams when I was in college, and it, you know, you have what, seven probably quote unquote big league teams in South Florida where I was living for college. If you count the Miami Hurricanes, which is a national brand, you know, it's stuff like that. Things would come through all the time, tennis, golf, whatever. Like there are opportunities for a young journalist there. And so, yeah, it is 100%. Geography. There's an old saying, geography is destiny, right? And I kind of feel like Florida was a great, great place for young sports journalists to grow up.
That might be the most romantic way anybody's talked about Florida in a long time.
I will talk about Florida romantically for as long as you'd like. I'm a big, big proponent of Florida. I think the chaos of it lends itself to being a good journalist, right? Like Carl Hyacin, who writes these novels, but also is a columnist. Like he used to talk so often about just how ridiculous Florida was. And you just kind of got this kind of gallows humor about the entire state And I think once you're in, my thing is once you're in on the joke of Florida and realize what it is and how ridiculous it is, you'll have a much better time in Florida.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think the way that you described the chaos of it all kind of really lends credence to the whole idea here. What was the first team you covered?
Great question. So it's kind of a moving target. So I went to DePaul University for 1 year and worked at the desk of the Chicago Tribune. Didn't really cover a team, went to a couple White Sox games, some freelance experience. And then in 2007, so I was a sophomore in college, I went down to South Florida to work for the Sun Sentinel. And there was a hugely lucky break, which is Alex Marvez, who is awesome, now does AEW. He had left for Fox Sports the day I became an intern. So they needed just a body at Dolphins training camp. I was 19, whatever it was. And they just sent me there and they're just like, get quotes. And newspapers being what they were, it took them a while to fill a position. And I just kept going back and going back and going back and getting in the Dolphins locker room and running quotes for Omar Kelly and Harvey Fialkov and Dave Hyde. And then they were just like, do you want to stay and not go back to college for a semester, do an extended kind of fellowship type thing, and essentially cover the Dolphins on a daily basis? I did other stuff. I did Heat, I did Hurricanes, all that stuff. But I just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And so the first team I ever covered was 2007 Dolphins. And if you remember that, that was the year after Saban, that was Cam Cameron. It was absolute despair. They went 1-15. They almost went 0-16. And being in that locker room, I actually kind of feel like it helped me a little bit because there were no stories to tell in that locker room. Like if you walked in on a daily basis, you're just like, what am I going to do? What am I right about Jesse Chapman as the third running back? Like, oh, wow. Cleo Lemons had two positive games in a row in losses, you know, to the Jets. Like, is that what we're going to write about? And so you had to really dig and you had to sort of go into it and say like, okay, there's obviously nothing to do about winning here. There's no star players. Like Ted Ginn, the first round pick, doesn't even look that good. You're going to have to find the story that doesn't really exist on the surface. And also say being the third quote unquote beat writer, even though I was still an intern, the number one story, you know, Ricky Williams came back that year. Okay, well, the number one beat writer's got that story. And then something else, number two beat writer will have the second biggest story. So if you're the number three guy at Dolphins camp, you're going to have to scramble and use a part of your brain that most people don't have to use. I kind of feel like it helped me a lot.
For sure. Do you remember any one particular story that stands out from that season that really demonstrates what you're talking about as far as using that different part of your mind and really having to dig
deep? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I remember I did a piece about, you would do profiles of guys that didn't necessarily matter, if that makes sense. Like I remember Sam Condado was on the Dolphins that year for a cup of coffee, and he'd played for the Packers the year before, and he was training to be a doctor in the offseason. So it's like, okay, let's just do as much as we can. Like, you know, one of the things, best advice my parents gave me was whatever job you're doing, do it to the best of your ability. So if I'm writing a Sam Condado profile, I'm gonna write the best damn Sam Condado profile I possibly can. So stuff like that. I remember writing a feature about players who were their own agents because there were a handful of them in the Dolphins locker room because there were a lot of those guys were on minimum salaries and they just represented themselves. And it was just an interesting year. I mean, Dante Culpepper was supposed to be on the team and he was barred from the training facility. I remember that also Ronnie Brown tore his ACL that year. And I remember for whatever reason, Ronnie Brown ended up giving me like 20 minutes just to talk about the rehab. And all we talked about was the mental part of it because everyone had talked about the physical part of it every single time. Every single time it was just, how's the knee? Is it 80%? Whatever. And I realized that no one had said like, what is this mental rehabilitation like for Ronnie Brown? And so I just remember talking to him for a while about that, where it's okay, I'm actually afraid to make cuts or I'm afraid to make the same move that led to the ACL. And you have to remember Ronnie Brown was the best player on the Dolphins at that point. Bill Belichick had said at one point that Ronnie Brown in 2007 was the best player he'd seen all year. So he was like a superstar down there. And so it's not just, okay, we're going to do the different angles on less famous players. It was when you're dealing with the more famous guy, you have to find an angle no one's asked about.
Did you know when you were showing up for your internship that that's what you were going to do? Because I know you said he left.
No.
Was that something that was set up or you just sort of.
No.
This is what we got to do. Oh, man.
They sent me there. It was great. I mean, like Omar Kelly and Harvey Fialkov were great beat writers to learn from. They were so gracious and courteous. And, you know, I remember doing Like I did a whole thing on the another example is like I did a thing on the practice squad, how it felt to be on the practice squad when it's the worst team in football. You can't even make the team when it's the worst team in football. I obviously I was a little nicer than that, yeah. But it's like that kind of stuff. And those guys empowered me to do that. And I kind of think the finding a good mentor and kind of going through with Dave Hyde to me was a genius. He's still there. He's a sports columnist. He's awesome. And he kind of taught me kind of whatever it takes to write a good story, you have to do. And he could write a great column, he could write a great feature. And so coming up in the industry, I was just so, so lucky to get those kind of breaks.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, obviously, sometimes it's just a matter of right place at the right time. You could have taken it.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I started at the same time as this other intern. Two guys started on the same day. And I want to put this guy on blast. He's not in the industry. But I was helped because they were divvying up the spots. And the other, for like, this guy gets this, this guy gets this. And the other guy was like, he was from Miami and I wasn't. And he was like, you know, I don't want to work nights because I don't want to sit in traffic. And the editors were like, oh, like this guy actually isn't like sports is, that means you can't go to a Marlins game. That means you can't go to a Heat game. That means you can't go to a late afternoon Dolphins practice. And so I actually got
insert kind of like,
yeah,
hand in hand. I mean, what are you doing?
And so I ended up getting his game load too. And so I was basically, so I would do Dolphins in the afternoon and Marlins at night or something like that. But my advice to young journalists is do not tell your bosses that you're afraid of traffic.
Yeah, I think that definitely starts you off on the wrong foot for sure. And then what happened after that? I mean, after you were done covering that season, what was the
next season? So I had to finish college. So I was able to kind of come to an agreement where I was sort of a correspondent, what they call a correspondent with the Sun Sentinel. So I was able to cover, I was at the University of Miami by this point, transferred. So I covered the Hurricanes every Friday. And then I would cover the Dolphins, I would cover the Dolphins every Friday. And I would cover the Hurricanes like during the week after practice, go out to Green Tree. That was the Randy Shannon era. Clayus Campbell was the tail end of that. Trying to think, Sam Shields was on that team, those kind of guys. Good, but not kind of glory years, Miami teams. But I was close to the Heat, so I was able to drive to there for practice when they needed me. And so I was just up for whatever. I'm going to sound completely insane, but I basically consolidated my class load so that I was only really going to class two and a half days a week, basically, so that then I could be available for whatever. Like I knew I wanted to be a sports journalist so badly that I would drop everything. And like, I would skip class all the time to go. And if it was a journalism class, they'd understand. I'd be like, hey guys, I really have to go to Heat practice. And if it's like an intro to journalism out there, I'm like, yeah, that's actually more valuable. But I was kind of a lunatic about just trying to do as much sports journalism as possible. And I would also say that when you're in those environments, you get to meet people who are really important to you. My absolute hero was Lee Jenkins. And I remember meeting Lee Jenkins at a Heat practice when I was in college, and that was just a great relationship to have. And so I think that that's just being, you know, 99% of life really is just showing up and being there and being present and saying yes to everything. And it all worked out.
Be right back with more gold after a word from our sponsors. The Press Pass podcast is brought to you by Manscaped. Go to manscaped.com and use the code FANSIDED20 to get a discount on the Performance Package 4.0. The brand new Lawnmower 4.0 is here to take the podium. The fourth generation trimmer features a cutting edge ceramic blade to reduce grooming accidents thanks to their advanced skin-safe technology. This package also comes with a weed whacker to chop your worst weeds up top in both your nose and your ear. This tool is a lock to take home gold in the biathlon. Get 20% off plus free shipping with the code FANSIDED20 at manscaped.com. That's 20% off plus free shipping with the code FANSIDED20 at manscaped.com. It does sound like this the time in college that you had really helped. I mean, maybe not calling it networking might not encompass everything about it, but I mean, it really
helped
a lot of relationship building and that sort of thing from all these people that you grew up reading.
Yeah. And then, so you get the opportunities. And then what happened to me was, so I was at a Heat practice on a random Friday or whatever. This is 2009. And Michael Beasley, just randomly in a press conference, was like, hey, no one ever taught me how to play defense. And I was just like, pardon me? He talked about how like basically the basketball AAU system had failed him to the point that he got to the NBA and had huge holes in his game and no one realized because of the athleticism that he had and all that stuff. So he was basically complaining about it. And I pitched it to my editors and they were kind of like, well, we've done the Beasley story. So I was still a freelancer. So I called the Wall Street Journal, who had just launched a sports section. So I was still a junior in college. And I said, hey, do you guys want the story? And they, Lord knows why they said yes, but they did say yes. And that started the relationship. And then when I got out of college a year later, they hired me. So I wrote a handful of freelance stories for them, kept in touch, and then got offered a job to be their Knicks writer, Knicks/Jets writer, when it launched, when they launched a new New York section a year later.
Why the Wall Street Journal? Why was that the one you decided to pitch to?
Well, they just launched a sports section and I saw that they were writing stories that were just a bit different, a little bit weird. And so when I joined the journal, I found out why. So they had this editor, Sam Walker, who I had a really good relationship with, and he instilled it in us to be a little weird. He used to say, if you go to press conferences, don't be in the pack. Do not be in the pack. Be somewhere else, pumping somebody else for information that nobody else is thinking about, right? And for me, I the best advice he ever gave me, and I think about it all the time, was he said that your story should be so unique and so interesting that the first quote in every story should be, I've never seen anything like it. And if you think about it, it kind of makes sense. Like the story should be so interesting and new that the people you're talking to are just like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. That's the only story you should write. Now, listen, we all have the realities of the business and you have to write more than the good ideas you have, but that's what you should be aspiring to. It's like the perfect thing. And so I was just this extremely dumb 24-year-old, 23, whatever. And I got there and they were all writing the stories I thought I could write. It took me a while to get there. Like having a high bar for yourself, like they do with the journal, like that does take a while. And so there was a 6-month period there where I thought that I came to work expecting to get fired. It turns out that was actually never on the table. I remember running that past. I'm really close with one of the other editors there. I was like, man, when I was first there, I thought they were going to fire me. And they're like, what are you talking about? So that was kind of my education really early on, was a sports section where they wanted to do things differently. And that's what helped me a lot. And the bar to get in the paper was really, really high. And you just had to sort of set new standards for yourself. And that's why I'm just forever in debt to the Wall Street Journal.
And you left college at kind of an interesting time in terms of the media industry as a whole.
Yeah.
It's like kind of the end of the newspaper era, but it's not dead yet. And you worked at newspapers in college, and then it's like the start of the online era. But
yeah.
What it looks like or anything. So, I mean, when you left college and you decided to go work for the Wall Street Journal, where was your mindset at as far as the future of journalism and that sort of thing, if you had that sort of foresight to think about it as a, you know, immediate post-college graduate?
Yeah. So I probably thought maybe that, I probably didn't have that much of a plan, except that the Wall Street Journal was a no-brainer. Like that's not something you think about for very long. Especially the sports section that was launching, and we could do interesting stuff with it. I would say that even when I was, 2008, 2009, I remember there were people in journalism classes who were just like, don't go into journalism. Journalism's dying. Don't try to work for a newspaper. And I thought the odds were against me to get a newspaper job. But it's funny, I was back in Miami, like, I don't know, two summers ago, pre-COVID. And I was just walking around. My wife and I were going to some of the old restaurants they should go to and stuff. And I was just thinking about how, like, the Wall Street Journal offering me a job out of college, it changed my expectations on things. But I actually thought I was just going to stay in Miami and just, like, cover the Hurricanes for 5 years. Like, I thought that I was going to have a traditional. I'll just tell the story. I don't think I've ever told the story. But when I was in college, I emailed David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker. And he didn't know who I was. And I was just like, hey, I just read King of the World, which is an amazing Ali book. Like, any advice you have for somebody who kind of wants to be like you, but sports. And he said in the email, he was like, this is 2009, I guess. He was just like, hey, I would tell you to go on the ladder, but the sports journalism ladder, but the ladder doesn't exist anymore. Like, there's no ladder anymore. It's 2009. And 10 years prior, I would have been able to go to the Miami Herald, the South Florida Sun Sentinel, the Orlando Sentinel, Jacksonville Times Union, Tampa Bay Tribune, cover a college team for 5 years, and then get a national job with that paper for 5 years, because they would still send people around the country. And then at age 33, you would be able to get, you know, so if you're talking 90s, you're talking Sports Illustrated. I don't know, listen, I'm just talking about the dream, right? Yeah. You're talking about Sports Illustrated in the 90s. You're talking about, you know, ESPN.com in 2001, whatever it is. That was the old trajectory. And by the time I came out, that trajectory didn't exist. Like, that was not, newspapers weren't adding, like local newspapers weren't adding. Being a local beat writer is still, I think, extremely fruitful experience. It's just less predictable than it used to be. Like, if you were in the 80s and you started out at age 23 as a college beat writer, you knew the trajectory. And I still think that some of the best writers on the planet are sports beat writers. It's just harder and harder to see, like, okay, are they going to get promoted with their own paper? Are they going to have to go to a website? Are they going to go have to do their own podcast? Are they going to do a Substack? Like, that, it just doesn't, the latter doesn't, it's just completely different now. It doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. It's really interesting talking to you, because I talked to Ira Winderman for this podcast.
My guy.
Your guy. And he laid out exactly what you just said about the path of, like, getting the job at the local paper, covering the college team for 5 years. He had some crazy things to say about the Hurricanes in those years, by the way. But it's
a lot of people have a lot of things, crazy things to say about the Hurricanes in those years.
But yeah, no, it's the parallel. It's like, you just laid out that whole path that Ira took, and you were just talking off the cuff, and that was just how it was done. And then you're coming up in the same, like, in the same state and sort of the same, like, circle with the newspaper that you worked at in college. And then you just took the different path. You skipped the ladder. You just went through it. I mean, I don't know what the new fucking metaphor would be for it instead of a ladder, but it's not chaos or anything. Yeah. You just flew off to a different area. It was, it worked out, obviously, but was it
100%. Yeah. But there was no plan. There was no plan. It was never like, I'm going to go to the Journal and I'm going to go here and here and here. Like, imagine Grantland didn't exist when the Wall Street Journal launched. And so how was I supposed to know that, like, you know, in 6 years, Bill Simmons was one of my heroes growing up. And I read him from the time I was 15. I was actually just talking to somebody about this the other day, just reading him when I was, you know, 15, 16, 17. But if you had told me, if you had stopped time in 2003 and said, you're going to be working for this guy, I'd be like, doing what? Like, that didn't make any sense that a writer would have this thing. But Bill was such a force that he's able to build two things that everybody loved. He's able to build a podcasting company, which, by the way, podcast didn't exist in high school when I'm thinking about becoming a sports journalist. And so everything is just changing constantly. And that's the big thing for me. And the dream changes constantly because of that, because there were, if I'm, you know, I used to have I probably still have on my bookshelf somewhere. I used to have a book of the best Sports Illustrated writing in 2002, 2003. And you're reading it and you're just like, oh, like Gary Smith, this is amazing. Well, that job doesn't really exist anymore unless you're going to carve out your own path. And some people are trying to do that, but that might exist on Substack. That might exist on your own Medium blog or whatever. You're just going to take those chances. I don't think you're going to have someone who's going to write once every 6 months, who's, you know, someone who was born in 1990. I don't think that person is going to be fully funded by some company, some media company, to do that. I just think that the realities change every 3 to 4 years. And if your expectations stay the same, that's where you're going to end up in a weird spot.
Yeah, and you used an interesting expression when you were speaking about that. The dream changes. So how did the dream change for you when you started at the Wall Street Journal to when you ended up leaving?
I would say it became a little more multimedia in this regard. Like, when I first started at the Wall Street Journal, I probably wanted to be like Michael Lewis. Like, mm-hmm. I probably, like, the thing that I try to do with every story is tell you why teams are winning and losing games. And that travels. If I'm writing about European soccer, I want to explain that. If I'm writing about the NFL, which is what I do 90% of the time, I want to explain that. I do some sort of more personality type stuff, and I enjoy doing that. But I think that the basis of sports information and telling people things is they just want to know if their team is going to win or lose games and why. And so I became obsessed with that in college, but then at the Journal, it was only more so. So I probably wanted to be like a sports writer who then wrote books that explained, hey, this team did this. I mean, exactly, kind of like a more more Michael Lewis without the money and tech part, right? Just sports. And I think that as the world changed and as podcasting became a bigger thing, as digital video became a bigger thing, I was decent enough at those to get those opportunities. And I felt like I was able to change it a little bit. And I think that if you come in now, if you were born in 1995 and you come into sports journalism now, I think you're going to have a tough time if you're saying I'm writing only. I think that you would limit the amount of places that you'd be able to go to, and you'd have to be there will be those jobs, those writing only jobs. They will exist, but you've got to be in the top 1% of 1% to have a career like you could 20 years ago if you're just writing only.
And you need to pump out an obscene quality or quantity.
That's correct. And quality.
Yeah, it has to be both. You have to be top 1% of 1% on both ends there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's just a different deal. And I think that, you know, I like writing once a week. I love writing once a week. I think it's important to be relevant. I don't think that, you know, you hear, I know this is crazy. I'm not comparing myself to them at all. We have totally different jobs, but you hear a story about like the people who are on contract at the New Yorker to write like twice a year. And it's like, I would go crazy. That's just how I'm wired. I want to write. I want to get my, if Aaron Rodgers gets traded in an hour, I want to have my thoughts up there. And you know, I do a lot of work to lay the groundwork to have educated pieces on that and educated thoughts on that. And so that's just how I'm wired, is to produce. And in many ways that kind of dovetails with the industry trends, but I'd want to do that even if I was born 1960.
No, absolutely. And yeah, no, it's like you said, I know what I twice a year, I donuts too, man. It's a certain quality to being able to like have a position where you write consistently. But it's the other aspects that go into that, not just the actual writing, but the stuff that you have to do around it is how you carve out a role in a company and media nowadays. But to get us back on track a little bit here, I mean, why? So Wall Street Journal was huge for your development in that regard and the growth of multimedia and the opportunities that you were granted there.
Yeah.
Then you ended up leaving. Walk us through that.
Okay, so 2014, I kind of hit a hot streak of stories. I did a piece about how, and this is a lot of this was kind of what we're talking about with being in the right place at the right time. I was just in NFL locker rooms, just trying to work as hard as I could. And I ended up getting a couple of stories. One was about Andrew Luck congratulating the people who sack him. They went viral. One was about the Packers playing Settlers of Catan. They went viral. A couple of those. And once that happened, started to get a little more attention, just because like the journal has like a most popular and most shared thing. And I was just noticing that we were writing the type of stories, this was all of the sports section, we were writing the type of stories that would get pretty high on that every time we would file. And so started to get a little more attention in 2014, came back in 2015 for that season and kind of continued a little bit on that. Great editors, great colleagues. It was just an awesome year. And then after that season, so I was on a plane going to Denver and for the AFC championship game after the 2015 season, I got an email from, this is either before plane Wi-Fi or there was some reason I couldn't get on Wi-Fi. Maybe it was like I was on like United or one of those crappy airlines that didn't have Wi-Fi. But I get on the plane and it like 1 minute before I'm about to take off, I get an email from Bill Simmons. It's like, hey, I think you would be great for what we're building here. And I couldn't respond because we were taking off and I was just
well,
like,
how long was this?
God.
How long?
Oh my God. I'm flying from New York to Denver. And so you're looking at, I mean like four hours probably going east to west. And so I was just like, okay. And so I'm just sitting there just like, what does he want me to do? Like I had so many questions and then yeah, it was wild.
Simmons, like he just emailed you.
Yeah. So I had met
information for 4 hours.
It's funny because I had met Bill as like a fan in the hotel lobby before the Eagles Patriots Super Bowl, just as a fan. I said, hi, my name is Kevin Clark. And he was super, super nice to me. And that was the only interaction that we had until then. And it was really funny because I actually didn't tell him that we met until I kind of gotten the job. I didn't want him to be like, I don't know. I didn't want it to change. So when we were meeting the first time and I went to the office and stuff, I wasn't going to be like, hey, we actually I introduced myself to you when I was whatever I was, 16. And so I thought, I always thought that was really funny, but he was super, super duper nice to me. So yeah, we had talked for about 15 seconds before he sent that email. I guess that would be 12 years prior to that. And so it was just awesome to connect him, to connect with him and then go out. So the Super Bowl was in San Francisco. Then I came down to LA and met with those folks. And then we hit it off, and it was honestly a no brainer.
Why? Besides, you know, Bill Simmons, which
we I mean, I would say that I have kind of like what we're talking about. Like, I think that there's value now, and there certainly was in 2016, and it's only grown now. There's value in being able to do everything. And I think that in 2021, the beautiful thing is that you can match the story with the medium. And what I mean by that is, like, you can do something and be like, actually, this isn't a print piece, this is a podcast, or this isn't a podcast, this is a video, or this is actually a narrative podcast instead of one podcast interview, right? This is four episodes, whatever. You can do that, and you can create a better product because of it. And The Ringer had the infrastructure for that. And I think that the one of the best career advice things I've ever gotten was from a media executive who said, any job in 2021 can be the best job in the world. You can make it into the best job in the world. Mm-hmm. So if you're at The Ringer and you're the NFL guy, you can have podcast, video writing, and you can use that as a launching point and do so many different things, become, you know, do X, Y, and Z that you want to do. Because you can do so many different things at The Ringer on so many different platforms, it is just the perfect sort of platform if you want to analyze the game, tell stories about the game, whatever it is. It's just a great place to be. It's just a creative, it's just a really creative place that probably does a great job of empowering people relative to other media companies. And there's a lot of great media companies out there, but I really like what The Ringer has sort of platformed.
No, absolutely. And what you said about what this kind of sports media and what The Ringer in particular has become for sports media in 2021 is huge. But when you pitched this was 2016. This is before it had even been launched yet. And this is, I mean, you know, it's Bill Simmons, but this is fresh off the Grantland thing. And I mean, were you nervous at all about jumping ship for the Wall Street Journal to go join this like brand new venture that had no guarantee of success, even if I'm sure the whole selling package was great and everything, but there still is that kind of risk factor of like, is this the right decision? Did you feel?
No, I wasn't nervous at all. And maybe I should have been more nervous, but I thought with Bill and the folks running it, Sean Fantasy, Mallory Rubin, Chris Ryan, Joy Libman, who I met with initially, I felt like there was going to be success, but B, even if the journal, in the worst case scenario, it still would have given me really cool opportunities and everything would have been fine, even in the absolute worst case scenario. And so I wasn't nervous at all. I knew it was going to succeed. And I knew that there were really smart people running it. And I honestly actually don't remember having any nerves that this was going to be not a success.
Well, clearly it was the right decision. How is the company, as somebody who was essentially in from the ground floor, I mean, how has the company and the website evolved in your view over the last 5 years?
It's a great question. I think that we obviously, since we work with Spotify now, I think that the scope of, you know, I think that the fact that we've been able to tell stories on narrative pods the last couple of years, where that's been Jordan Kahn's great work, Tyler Tynes, I think that that's been a priority for us. I think that's really cool. It's not something that I've personally done, but I really think that's cool. And I think that things are just getting bigger and bigger. And I think that the ability to bring on Ariel Helwani is amazing. I think the ability to bring on Sean McVay for a series is amazing. Last year we had Pete Carroll and Steve Kerr. It's stuff like that. It's using the resources that we have, both the influence and, you know, Spotify's connections, our connections. There's just so many different opportunities. I would say that the beginning was, you know, we were all just kind of scrambling. And I certainly was. I was just writing as much as I possibly could and just trying to eke out, you know, the one thing that, and I've joked about this before, but like, it was completely different audiences. And I didn't know, the one thing I didn't know was that the people, and this was just something that got out of my brain very quickly, but the people who read you and the people who listen to you and will watch you on whether that's Slow News Day, NFL show, and the writing part of it, completely different audiences, mm-hmm. completely different audiences. And I had actually thought in the beginning in 2016 that there was going to be kind of a ringer core audience, and that they were, if I was going to say, well, as I wrote this week, and it's like, wait, no, no one, some people don't even know I'm a writer. You know, I remember something like, you know, and people on Slow News Day who watch Slow News Day might not know, whether that's on YouTube or on Twitter, might not know that I have a podcast. Truly. Like it's just people are just too busy to sit around and consume everything I do. And so understanding that was probably pretty important at the beginning. And understanding, I mean, how to podcast in the beginning was tough. And it wasn't, I probably got caught up to speed pretty quickly, but I think that just knowing what the pacing is, knowing what works, knowing what people like to talk about, and also kind of what you want to do. I mean, you're creating, you know, I could have come out and said, you know, the Patriots should fire Bill Belichick in September of 2016 and created some crazy persona. And you have to think very carefully about everything you're saying. For the most part, if you make one or two huge mistakes, just from a, you know, whether that's a half-baked take or whatever, people might stop listening to your show. And so you just have to make sure that you're always doing your best, doing the research, working your ass off on even something like a podcast that, you know, to me is, I love doing research for the podcast. I love digging in and saying, okay, we just recorded top 10 GMs and you're going through salary cap stuff and you're going through draft stuff. And it's like, if you're not doing that work, you're going to say something stupid on a podcast. And that to me is something I think that more people who aren't more podcast focused should probably think about.
Definitely. How has your work as a writer evolved since you've gotten to the writer?
Well, it's gotten a lot longer because at the journal, we had a cap of like 1400 words, like absolute cap. Sometimes it'd be 1000 words. So I would do these pieces. They were so, they could be short. So like I did a piece in 2014 about NFL, there were fights in NFL locker rooms because the different players were at different episodes of Game of Thrones because it had come out in that summer. And so it was like, oh my God, this guy just talked about the Red Wedding. This guy hasn't even seen the Red Wedding, like that sort of thing. But you could write that at 1000 words and it'd be a full story and it'd be fine. I think that if I got that story now, it would actually be woven into something that's maybe more of a 2000 word type column. Yeah. And you'd have to flesh it out a little more on all that stuff. That's just the economy of the internet. And so I feel like I've become a better writer. I've been able to sort of flex that muscle a little bit, I would say, and use some of the kind of tricks that I like to use. I would say that at the journal, there's kind of an editorial voice there where they don't want in their non-columns, so like the stories I would write, they you know, you would get edited and stuff like that, to the point that, you know, I don't want to say they want every story to sound alike, but if you have too much voice, in a news story, they might take a little bit out. Whereas at the Ringer, I can kind of use whatever voice I'd like to do. And I have a great relationship with my editor, Connor Nevins. And I think that there's just a little more freedom than working for a newspaper that has, you know, 2 million subscribers, most of whom are subscribing to for earnings and stuff like that and business stuff. And I adore the Wall Street Journal. My wife still works there. It's just a different writing environment.
No, for sure. And I think it goes along with a lot of more traditional outlets where it's the voice of the outlet. It's the voice of the Wall Street Journal, and there is some like it aspect of each writer's personality that they're allowed to inject, but there's only a certain amount of certain limit to that. Whereas at places like The Ringer and a lot of other media companies nowadays, the selling point of each individual personality is what keeps audiences engaged, because, you know, nobody knew what The Ringer was before it started up.
Right.
And then it was about sort of the name recognition and the brand building and the individual brand building for that helps keep a loyal audience.
The brand thing was really interesting to me because there were so many NFL teams. So the Ringer launches on June 1st. and 2016. Mm-hmm. And then I go on my training camp tour a month and a half later. And I had a pretty good relationship with most NFL teams and that kind of stuff. But I really had to explain to them exactly what I was doing. And there, you know, it was because I'm sending my asks in June and, you know, these guys are on vacation all of June. And a lot of them kind of knew it existed and had consumed, you know, I think everybody in the NFL listens to Bill and hopefully some of them listened to me. You know, the Ringer NFL show was myself and Robert Mays. And I think that it changed very quickly. It flipped very quickly and people knew who we were by 2017 at the latest. I'm talking about people in the league. People in life knew what the Ringer was and had this brand affinity because of Grantland and all the goodwill that was built up. And also the fact that the Ringer, I think, started out so well and was drawing a lot of attention. But I think people within sports, it took a little bit. But by 2017, I didn't have to explain it. And now, by now, I never have to explain it. I mean, it totally flipped. People are begging for coverage in, you know, some corners, and we can get anybody for Slow News Day, except Patrick Mahomes at this point. We've asked, but you know, that's Lamar Jackson, Baker Mayfield. We got Canelo for 20 minutes on Slow News Day. Like, we're able to get this stuff, and a lot of that is the power of the Ringer.
Now I have to earn my salary, so stay tuned for more Press Pass after this. Yeah, and it's really interesting, just like the power that just the idea of a brand holds nowadays. Like, I feel like
that's
changed drastically over the last 10 years, is how much influence you can gain just by being affiliated with a certain name.
Yes, and I will also say that changes so quickly. Like, that's kind of what we're talking about, where Ringer didn't exist 5 years ago, and now we can get interviews with anybody because we're the Ringer. And I would say that, you know, media companies are always rising and falling. And there are some brand names where they don't have the same equity as they did 5 years ago and couldn't get the same amount of guests. And so it's just really interesting to watch how that works, but it's been a huge, huge positive for the Ringer.
No, absolutely. And now you've mentioned Slow News Day a couple of times over the last few minutes here. How did you come up with the idea of Slow News Day?
All right. So it wasn't all me. In fact, it was mostly not me. We had put something, so Jason Gallagher, my producer, had put some stuff on tape and we were just messing around with it. Bill happened to stumble upon it, really liked it. We workshopped it. I believe Bill was who came up with the Slow News Day name, because we were going to put it out on Tuesdays or Wednesdays, which was the slowest part of the NFL schedule. And it was the first year was just Ringer guests, and it was just like Chase Serrano, Julia Littman, Mallory Rubin, Jason Concepcion was on the pilot. I don't know if that actually ever made the airwaves. We had Jason on for an actual episode as well. And then people liked it, and people, it was just a little bit different. And I was getting emails from people in television being like, what is, like, we're intrigued by this. What is this? They wanted, you know, the people were ripping it off. And that was the highest form of flattery for us. And it was just fun. It was just a fun thing to do with my friends. Nobody was watching it that first year. We put it on Twitter. We get 40,000 views, which is, you know, now if we put it something out on Twitter, it gets, you know, at least, you know, probably around 200. And, but nobody was watching it, but we were having a great time and we were developing an audience. And then the next year we went to the Super Bowl and we realized that people wanted to, like, we thought we were just in kind of just hanging out and doing something for ourselves. And then when we got to the Super Bowl, we realized that people kind of wanted to be a part of this. Mm-hmm. So we were able to program it with a bunch of NFL players, a bunch of media members. It was really fun. And then the year after that, it just gained a lot of momentum, and we were able to get Lamar Jackson. We were able to get, you know, I mean, this year, Collinsworth, Adam Schefter, Sean Payton, Joe Montana. I mean, just kind of anybody. I don't, with the exception of Mahomes, I don't think there's been anybody we've tried to get that we haven't been able to get in some form or fashion. And I think that's been the most fulfilling thing to me, is I would want to do this. Hell, even if we never release this, I would like to talk to those guys, Richie Bozek, Jason Gallagher, Jackson Safon, and just like Corey McConnell, and just sort of like have fun with them. And the fact that people seem to like it is just like one of the great dumb joys of my life. And so I just think it's really fun, and it's something that is easy to do, and we developed a nice little audience, and I'm just I'm thrilled. Like I am beyond lucky that our stupid video series has found a nice little niche.
Sometimes things just happen. And you talked a lot about, you know, the different hats almost that you have to wear at the
ring. Yeah.
Choose to wear. And so as far as the like Slow News Day and kind of on camera personality aspect goes, what do you enjoy most about doing that and exploring that aspect of journalism that you couldn't have necessarily done 5 years ago, 6 years ago?
Yeah. And what I'd say about that is like, Slow News Day is so different from the podcast or the writing. And it's so fun. Kind of what I was talking about earlier, where you can fit the story to the medium. It's so fun to figure out what everything should be. So I'll give you an example. Carson Palmer was booked for us Super Bowl week. And I'm thinking like, okay, I can do the whole Slow News Day shtick and do Carson Palmer, whatever. But I think this is best served. Bruce Arians is about to play in a Super Bowl. Quarterbacks are asking out, just like Carson Palmer did. This is actually a pod conversation, right? Like, we don't need Carson Palmer looking through the newspaper. We need actual football discussion. So we made a football discussion and we put it on the podcast. We didn't do Slow News Day. Sean Payton, we did the podcast and Slow News Day, but Sean Payton was just so good and so up for anything that it was hilarious. He's talking about eating a tub of ice cream after he gets eliminated by the Rams in that game and all that stuff. It was just hilarious. He loved the Queen's Gambit. Mm. And so exploring who would be good for what, like I had Peter King on Slow News Day and the podcast last year and different hits. And they were completely different conversations, And like Peter almost wanted to do, like he literally said he was going to have the hottest takes in the history of Slow News Day and just came in just firing on all cylinders. Whereas on the podcast, we would be a little more reserved. And, hey, let's talk about this for 10 minutes kind of thing. And so I think that that's the most fun thing for me is figuring out what everything should be. And I just think that it's, you know, a written piece. If I get I'm making this up, but if I get Andrew Berry, the GM of the Browns, for access next week, it's probably gonna be a written piece. Probably better if I contextualize it, all that stuff, and am able to build around and make other calls and stuff like that. But as you saw, Baker Mayfield was available and we put him on Slow News Day because we know he'd be fun. He could talk about UFOs. He could talk about the draft process, whatever it was. And so that to me is the most fun thing is figuring out what story we're going to tell based on who's available and what we have at our disposal.
Absolutely. And then when you look towards the future and you think about the opportunities that you have at the Ringer and the ways that you can keep spreading your wings as a journalist, what do you anticipate being something that you really want to improve on as you just keep moving forward day after day?
That's a great question. I mean, I'm always trying to become a better writer and tell the definitive story about whatever I happen to be writing about. What I would say is in my mind, the next frontier is the NFL will always be my primary thing. The Ringer NFL show will always be the primary thing that I do. I would say that what I would like to do is be able to peel off every once in a while. Not certainly the NFL is a full-time job and I have so much respect for the people. Sometimes I get offended when someone tries to cover another sport and it's just like, wait a second. Like, have you ever watched this sport? Like, what are you doing? Right. And because I realize how hard it is to cover the NFL on a daily basis that to go in and say like, oh yeah, I'm the tennis guy now. It's like, wait, what? Huh? Like, no, it takes me like hours and hours and hours a week just to know what I'm talking about. And so for anyone to be like, oh, I'm the tennis guy now. Like that to me is something that's always on my radar. Mm. But what I would say is like, I have a real passion for other sports, whether that's college football, which is an easy lift. I have done a lot of reporting in the past on sort of college schemes and college players and how that's affected the NFL. I would say that something like golf, which I've written about this year, Ryan Russillo and I have been doing Going Abroad on a Formula One segment three times in the last month. And for some reason, people like that. That's one of those things where it's just like, I feel so lucky that Ryan Russillo and I, we had Big Cat on yesterday. We'll just joke around about Formula One. People are like, this is good. And it's like, wait, what? Okay. And so it's maybe a little more experimentation as far as the sports go, as far as, okay, maybe I continue to do F1 on Russillo. Maybe I continue to do a little more college football. Golf is something over the past year that I've gotten a little more I've worked really hard to get a little more comfortable to be an expert there. Again, that's the kind of thing where it's like, there are some really smart people covering golf. So I would have to work my ass off to get to a point where I can talk about it. But I feel like I've been able to do that. I've been on the Ringer Golf Podcast a handful of times. So maybe a little more of that. But I think that we're in a pretty good place, man. And I think that there's, if I did do Formula One golf, it's not about becoming sort of Rick Riley 1995 and doing a different sport every week and doing baseball or whatever. Like, I'm never going to get to that point because my major will always be NFL, but I think you can minor in a bunch of other different stuff. And I kind of feel like probably if there's any next step for me, that's a little bit different, it would be occasionally a little more college football, a little more golf, a little more Formula One, a little more soccer, the sport I love, although we have amazing soccer coverage. And then I'm certainly not going to be any better than the Stadio guys or Ian Wright. Like, we have Ian, that's another example. We have Ian Wright doing a podcast for us. Like, this is a guy who's an Arsenal legend. Like, what the hell am I going to do if I go on that podcast? And it's like, well, Ian, you know, you scored more goals than anybody in your era, but here's what I think about Spurs. Like, no, come on, man. No. But I think that there are opportunities in other areas.
Yeah, and I think the major minor metaphor that you made is a really perfect analogy for it, especially at a place like the Ringer, where one of the things I've noticed is that there is just no hesitation, no barriers for all of the various talents that you guys employ to dip toes in other waters and appear on other sports podcasts and do pop culture stuff. And I think that's one of the most interesting things about the Ringer is that it sort of set that standard. Maybe it wasn't the first one to ever do that sort of thing, but it set the standard of how good it can be when you have so many multi-talented
100%. And you know, that was the thing when I was talking to somebody about the Formula One stuff a couple of weeks ago, and we were just joking around, and I was like, you know, I kind of feel like there needs to be like a Formula One expert kind of at our beck and call, so we can understand, okay, what's this diffuser situation with Red Bull, like what's with the rear wing. And someone was just kind of like, you know, I actually think that would stymie it a little tiny bit. And it's just more about people who really work hard to understand what's going on and then just having fun doing it and the chemistry and liking the personalities. And I do think that's part of it, is that we're all sort of omnivores in a lot of different ways, and that we're able to say, you know, you look at someone like Chris Ryan, who can appear on 100 different podcasts talking about 100 different things and be a great guest on all of them. He knows a hell of a lot more different things than I do, and I will never be at Chris Ryan's level. But it's something that we should all probably aspire to at the Ringer, where you can do a TV podcast and then you can do an NBA podcast, and then if you wanted to, you could hop on Slow Newsday and talk Eagles, which he has done, talk soccer, obviously, which he has done. I just think that that's the model for the Ringer, is just being able to hop on any podcast anytime and be entertaining as hell.
Absolutely. And one of the, I mean, as you previously mentioned, the Ringer podcast network purchased by Spotify for a pretty substantial number. And it seems like, with last year aside, with all the weird social audio locker rooms that variously popped up, podcasts are almost, they're becoming really, really important in media as an industry. Now, just as somebody who's been kind of in the thick of that and somebody who works at the Ringer, which is probably the most, you know, the Spotify deal was the most covered podcast deal this side of Joe Rogan in the last like 3 or 4 years. You know, how do you view the kind of the future of podcasts as it's in a role of media?
Great question. I don't know. I mean, here's the thing. I wasn't smart enough to see the podcast boom coming when Bill was building it, right? Like, I was just sitting there at the Wall Street Journal pumping out 1,400 word stories about Andrew Luck and David Bakhtiari and Aaron Rodgers, right? So it's hard for me to predict anything in that genre, because I don't pretend to be a media executive. If elected to be a media executive, I would not serve. It's hard for me to answer that. I really don't have an answer, because podcasting has changed so much. And obviously you're seeing with some of the recent deals that if you have a brand name in podcasting, you can build an audience very quickly and do very well. And I think that that's been interesting to watch. you know, I'm a really big fight fan and MMA fan. And so I've listened to a lot of Joe Rogan, especially when he has UFC fighters on or jujitsu practitioners or boxers, which he has had on intermittently. And so I kind of understand the value of not only serving your niche, which Joe Rogan does, but also obviously the general population. If Joe Rogan just did a UFC podcast, I promise you, he would not have sold for that much money. And so it's been interesting to watch sort of how that develops. And I just think the biggest thing is developing an audience and communicating with your audience and embracing it and knowing not only what they want, but knowing that's always changing. And it's kind of like what we're talking about previously where, you know, listen, if I really like doing green rooms, I hopped on one with Van Lathan after the Logan Paul Floyd Mayweather fight. I hopped on a couple with Bill for the Masters and then the US Open. I really like that. And I think that can be really fun. Almost like what, you know, you bring people up and have them ask questions and get viewpoints you would normally get. The one thing you can't do in a podcast is bring in audience members. And, you know, we have some of our podcasts now have voicemails and stuff like that. That's a little different than bringing people in real time and having them ask questions. And so there's a freshness in that. So I really do like the locker room thing. And I think that's something we can build on, but I do think that the podcast thing, it's just so ever changing to predict what pods will look like in 2024 is really hard, except to say I'll be doing it in some way.
All right, Kevin, I have one last question for you, and it sort of relates to what you were just talking about your inability to forecast the podcast market, but it just is an overarching, you know, idea about this industry and this job that you now have and the way that you work your way up the ladder in a much different way than a lot of other people have. What's something about this job that you know now that you kind of wish you knew back when you were starting out at the Sun Sentinel as an intern?
Oh, wow. Oh my gosh. I wish I had prepared for this. Great question. I would say number one is do not overthink athlete interactions. That'd be number one. Like I came into him and be like, oh my God, what's Dontrell Willis going to think of me at his locker? And the answer is Dontrell Willis is not, like Mad Men joke. Dontrell Willis is not thinking about you at all. You're doing your job. He's doing his. That's really important. I think young journalists get really intimidated sometimes. Ooh, I have to ask a question to Aaron Rodgers. 9 times out of 10, he will answer the question based on the merits of the question, not whether or not he knows who you are or likes you. I mean, like, first of all, Aaron Rodgers answer any question in group setting, obviously. But I just think that a lot of times there's an intimidation factor that I certainly had coming into NFL locker rooms, MLB locker rooms, NBA locker rooms. And these guys see so many different faces in the locker room all the time that unless you're a huge name, you're kind of one of many. And so never be intimidated by that. Don't be shy. I mean, that was some great advice I got early on is when you're in these cities or you're in a training camp tour or whatever, don't just say, hey, can I get the third linebacker? Like just try to write the best story you can. And the worst thing that they're going to do is say no. And like rejection is a huge part of this industry. I send so many emails asking to talk to a GM, talk to a coach, whatever. And you have to know that, that you're going to get rejected a handful of times. And, you know, I've never interviewed Bill Belichick one-on-one, but I ask all the time whenever I'm writing a story. He doesn't give me very many one-on-ones, and the people he does give to, he's known them for 30 years in most cases, or they're local. But as far as national guys go, it's pretty hard to get on a schedule. I'm okay with that. I'm going to keep trying because one day maybe it'll happen for a big story. And the worst you get is Josh McDaniels or, you know, whatever. And so when you ask them, so I think that there's, I'm trying to think what else I wish I knew. I would say, and this is a weird one, but I actually, one of the biggest things that shaped maybe the first year of my coverage was I heard a story from a Dolphins employee who said that Nick Saban looked at I think there was some practice or some NFL event, maybe it was even the combine. And Nick Saban looked at all the reporters and was like, why do so many people like not dress well? Like, why do they just wear like cargo shorts and a t-shirt? And the person was like, I don't know why you're complaining with this. And he's like, don't they have any respect for their job? And I was like,
First of all, what a weird thing to say. But then on the other hand, like, I actually did start, like, I really did. I was 19 or whatever, and I just started dressing up a little bit because of that, because it's like, you actually can't, I'm not saying wear a suit and a tie to practice. Do not do that. But I am saying that in some, if you want to develop relationships or just make sure you're not eliminated by some weird thing, I would say that putting a little, I dressed very poorly at the very beginning. And then I kind of put myself together a little bit more. And I actually think in some weird ways that that tended to help in, you know, if you're getting an extra 0.5% in a story, in building stories over the course of the year, it's worth it. So I went out and bought some nice clothes after hearing that story. And I don't know if it worked or not, but I think about it a lot.
Nick Saban inspired Kevin Clark to dress better. That's a headline right there.
It is. It is.
All right. Great stuff, Kevin. Thank you so much for coming on the Press Pass podcast, man. I really appreciate it. That was a really interesting conversation, and I wish you the best of luck going forward. And I think, you know, the Ringer's set to do some good stuff, and it was amazing being able to talk to you about, you know, the path it's on and the path it's going towards.
Awesome. Thank you so much, man.
Yeah, appreciate it. And thank you, listeners, as always, for tuning into the Press Pass podcast. I am your host, Liam McEwen, signing off.